Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History in Technicolor with myself and with...
me, Wolf O'Neill.
Wolf and I have been discussing the etymology of the word phlegm, because unfortunately I have a lot of it, and I'm hoping it won't come into this episode, and it's obviously a deeply disturbing thing to discuss, so I'd like to formally apologise, nor will I say moist, which is also... a thoroughly unpleasant word. Anyway.
I was just going to say move along.
Yes, get on with it. So we're here today to talk about a film called Peterloo. Would you like to know, Wolf, why I selected Peterloo?
Yes, I've been wondering that, especially because you were going to pick something else. So why did you pick Peterloo? And what spurred you on right
now? Yes, it's true. I was going to pick Death of Stalin, wasn't I? Well, I've been fighting very hard not to watch Peterloo because I was scared of it, because I thought, look, I'm going to get preached at for 2.5 hours by Mike Lee, who I put in the same category as Ken Loach, as kind of, well, if I'm in the right mood, obviously I realise they're a great filmmaker, but, you know. Mm-hmm. So I've been resisting it. But then Jane said, because we were having a takeaway, because which we get from the local pub that Jane has to go and drive out to, because I'm sort of immunity issues, so I can't. And she said that she would quite like to watch Peterloo while we ate this takeaway.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a vindaloo.
No, that would have been too clever for me. But it would have been great to have a vindaloo while watching Peterloo, I've got to say. Anyway, so that's the very thin reasons why I chose it. Also, I'm doing... some shedcasts on the British Constitution, another product placement opportunity. And Peterloo has an interesting part to play in the development of English radicalism.
Yeah, well, it was very interesting.
Okay, so let me describe briefly what it's about, and then I will ask you a couple of questions,
okay,
if I might. So it's a 2018 film, probably created to celebrate, if that's the right word, the Peterloo Massacre, which occurred in 1819. It was directed by Mike Lee, and it is about a massacre that happens at a radical political meeting in Manchester. The film sets the social and economic scene and introduces us to a cast of characters from, and it starts at the end of the Napoleonic War in 1815 and goes through to the massacre. The characters include a whole range of society, from Prince Regent, who's actually a bit of a hoot, Lord Liverpool, who's the PM and his Home Secretary, to the local magistrates, who are the ones who are deeply involved in the events, and then the radicals and the local society of people. The story moves from a varied discussion and movement about radicalism. It gives you lots of detail and examples of the different types of radicalism going on, to the big showdown, the big meeting at Peterloo. And it shows you how the dastardly magistrates who ruthlessly caused the massacre. But one of those receptions where the critics were much more favourable than were the audience. The Guardian went, you know, 5 out of 5 stars on it, because this is a film that could have the Guardian stamp on it. It's got the Guardian written all over it. Sort of an ensemble cast, kind of no big names, but, you know, some reasonably well-known English actors. So Rory Kinnear is the orator. Maxine Peake is one of the characters. Tim McInerney is the Prince Regent.
Yep. And the dad from Good Vibrations was in it.
Was he?
Was he not?
He could well have been. Also, the chap from Shameless, I think, was in it. No, the chap from The Detectorists, which could be one of the greatest TV series ever made. He's one of the guys with the... Anyway. So it's kind of, you know, lots of faces you know without there being, you know, Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie, that sort of thing. Cost $18 million to make. Is that a lot or is that a little?
I assume it's not a lot.
Right, okay. It's done by Amazon Studios. Mike Lee is a bit of a well-known name, and I had a look into this because, you know, unlike you, I don't know much about films. And his top grossing movie was Secrets and Lies back in 1996, which that film got 5 Oscar nominations, and it made $26 million in today's dollars. So that's sort of a sign of the scale. But when I looked at the list of films, actually, I didn't see any ones that I, as a film ignoramus, really saw. But he's a famous name, isn't he?
Yep, definitely.
So tell us, Wolf, about the way Mike Lee makes films, because Jane tells me that's a subject of particular interest, that he's a bit of a loony.
Interesting. Okay.
She didn't use the word loony. That's my word.
Okay. I was like, it's an interesting type of filmmaking branded loony. just a note, because I quickly did my research to double check. Yes, Carl Johnson, who plays Lord Sidmouth in this, was the dad in Good Vibrations, which I thought you would have recognized immediately.
Being
an Uber fan.
Yes. I'm going to go and thrash myself in the morning dew with some hazel twigs.
It's been a while since you've done that, so glad.
It is. I've missed it.
Yeah, good. Okay, so I have probably much the same general impression of Mike Lee that you do. I've seen Vera Drake, and I've seen bits and pieces of, I think, Topsy Turvy and another one. And I've seen numerous clips of his work throughout various television shows and highlight reels that I've watched. And I'm usually aware of his presence. And around the time this movie was playing, we went to watch a Korean movie at the London Film Festival called Burning. And Mike Lee was sat in the audience a couple of rows over watching it with us. Presumably,
did he go and ask for his autograph?
No, but it was quite funny because
he
was at the festival because he was doing some talks and he was hosting this film there, but he was pretty much ignored in the crowd. Just this little old man sat there enjoying himself. he has great taste in films. We had a wonderful time. I say together, but he didn't know who I was.
Right.
So a little bit of background for him. So he trained as an actor.
Okay. I have to tell you, actually, Wolf, that he speaks very highly of you.
Oh, good. Well, I'm pleased. I'm glad I had an impact from across the room watching a movie.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I can't shut him up.
Okay, so he trained as an actor first and did a lot of work in the theatre. And this is kind of pivotal to his like technique that he carries out now. As a result, his films are very character focused and they tend to examine, I guess, everyday lives. So I tend to think of them as like kitchen sink movies or like British realism. You might also describe them as domestic dramas. So they tend to be about his central characters are like taxi drivers, in Happy Go Lucky, or just the average Joe. Usually like the working class as well. And I think predominantly set in London as like a main hub, although he was from Manchester. So he uses his theatre background to inform his work with his actors. They do extensive rehearsals, lots of improvisation with the characters long before they start shooting the film. So it's a little bit like preparing for a play. And then they can embody those characters completely. A key aspect of his work is to examine his political and personal views, especially kind of regarding the working class. So he'll often look at the class struggle, and I guess in a similar way to Ken Loach, he's examining how society in Britain works and the impact that kind of legislature and everything has upon people's lives. So Vera Drake is about how Vera was carrying out secret abortions during a time when it was illegal, and the kind of lives of her and her family during that time and what it was like to be a woman at that time. Does that kind of embody what you envisaged he would be?
Yes, almost 100%. The thing I was particularly interested in was improvisation. So does he actually use a script? Because I'd have thought Jane was kind of suggesting not-ish. There was a lot of improvisation. But I would have thought this is an extremely difficult film to do without a script because there's a lot of speechifying.
I got the impression that the script is a very loose structure in the beginning, but that they essentially write the script with the actors through the process of creation.
Ah, I see.
So he will work one-on-one with the characters, and they'll develop to being in costume, and they'll do this for months. And I think, if I'm correct, they will start to figure out who the character is together, collaboratively. And then once that actor has found the voice of their character, that's kind of when they begin to put more stuff concretely down into a script format. It's kind of created together. But I would imagine there is some improvisation within the film.
Okay, great.
I'm guessing in Peterloo that, especially towards the end, like it must be meticulously planned in order to carry out that kind of finale.
Yes, gotcha. Okay, so another question for you, Wolf. What were your expectations before you watched the movie?
I would say the same as you, pretty negative. I thought it was going to be awards baity. I thought it was going to be boring. I thought it was going to be kitchen sinky. I thought it was going to be a chore, to be honest. And I knew the running time was massive.
So in summary, not entirely positive.
Yeah, and if I'm right in remembering, apart from that Guardian review, which gave it 5 stars, my general memory was that it was like a 3-star movie. Like, the general consensus was like, oh yeah, it's fine to good. And I just wasn't convinced I wanted to watch that for 3 hours. But I will say immediately that I'm so glad I watched it.
Very good. Yes, critic gave it 66%. Audience score was about 40% sort of thing. Okay, very good. And indeed, those are my expectations too. So do you know what the answer is to a happy life, Wolf?
I have no expectations.
Correct. Low aspirations are the answer to a happy life. You know, all they tell you at school about how you have to have high expectations, high aspirations. It's all tripe. Okay? You heard it here.
Well, David, I have one question for you before we really dissect the film. This is based on a particular scene in the movie, but I really thought it might connect with you. So apologies if it doesn't. I wanted to know how excited you would be if you had been on your travels and knew that when you got home, there would be a hot potato pie waiting for you.
Yes, I would be extremely excited. You can't beat a hot potato pie.
Good. And that's the level of detail and research that has gone into this movie, because that's exactly what the character says in the film. And I was like, I need to know if this is true. And the person to ask is David.
Absolutely excellent. But it also serves to show that the diet of the working classes was extremely straightforward. And, you know, you're giving an impression straight away on what life was really like. So let's go into the film. I'm going to give you a quote from Mike here, okay, so that you can judge the film against Mike's objectives.
Okay.
I want you to leave engaged with your emotions, feelings of sorrow, sympathy, and anger. It was iniquitous what happened. Here is democracy in action. Here are genuine hopes that come out of genuine things in people's lives, to be dealt with in this destructive, chaotic, blind, insensitive, self-serving way by people in power. All those things remain resonant as far as I'm concerned. Okay?
Yeah, I think he achieves it.
And I think he achieves it too. But I'm a little bit more qualified than you, because I'm a little bit more conservative than you are. So here's how I feel about the film as a whole. There were pros and cons. It's a bit like a curate's egg. Do you know about the curate's egg?
I think so, but explain it again, please.
The curate goes to visit the bishop, and the bishop gives him breakfast. And at breakfast, the curate is given an egg, which is bad, which is a bit foul, obviously. But nonetheless, the curate feels very nervous of this, and so he starts to eat it. The bishop notices, and he says, "Good Lord, how terrible. Your egg is bad." And the curate says, "No, no, it's good in parts."
Okay, yes.
I don't really know why I told
you that. So the film is good in parts.
It isn't rotten, obviously, but it's good in parts. So here are the good things, I thought. The scenery, the costumes, they all do a very good job of evoking the time and the environment. Absolutely fantastic for that. As good as Master and Commander. It does a great job of being historical. He's obviously worked really hard about that, and we'll come back to that. And it has some nuance in it. So that quote gives you the idea this is going to be a Ken Loach crusading movie, and it is in a way, but it also shows you the nuance. So it shows complexity of opinion among the working class. Some of them don't want to do all this marching. They think it's a rubbish idea. There are some people who want to carry weapons and cause fire, you know, be violent. Henry Hunt, the orator, the big radical orator, is not described entirely positively. The mass scene, the denouement at the end, is very good indeed and very well organized. It goes on for quite a while, but you don't lose interest. He makes a great effort to develop a smorgasbord of well-developed character, with Joseph as a figure to follow all the way through. Joseph is actually a fictional figure, as a sort of way to give you a connection and a final pathos when Joseph, at the end of the movie, when Joseph does what Joseph does. And he works very well, very nicely, I think, Joseph, as a very poor working class figure who's destroyed by the Napoleonic Wars, basically. He sort of loses his mind almost. He works as the fantastic contrast with a very posh general, John Byng, who lives a life of luxury after the war. So those are the pluses, I thought. The cons were, there were way too many speeches of way too much length. I mean, just give me the general idea, Mike, really. You can see him trying to build the characters and show a variety of opinion, but there's just far too many characters, I think, to really get involved with any one of them in any great depth. And that has an impact, had an impact on me on the amount of emotion I invested in it. So there's almost too much history. Can there be such a thing, Wolf? Can there be too much history?
I guess in this case, yes.
Well, yeah, because generally, obviously, there can't. But in this, there is too much. The faction that wanted to arm everybody, for example, arrives and disappears. And you kind of think, well, you could have cut all that, to be honest. Didn't really need it to make a story.
Mm-hmm.
Then the sort of 50-50 things I'm even on, it's a bit stodgy, but there is a little bit of humour. So, for example, Henry Hunt, the orator, the posh orator, slightly posh orator from London, has to be housed in one of the working class folks' house. And he goes up to his room and he says, "Bring me a light repast." And the maid servant looks at him, you know, aghast, because she's, you know, she doesn't know what he means. She says, she whispers, "What does he want?" So it was just quite nice. And the Prince Regent is delightfully over the top in a very Tim McInerney way.
Yeah, there's definitely quite a lot of comedy, and it's quite astute as well. When the potato gets thrown through his carriage window,
yeah,
and then you see the story progressing from it's a potato, then it's possibly shot from an air rifle, then it's potentially big rocks, and you can see it kind of the stone rolling downhill, and people exaggerating the story.
Yes, and using it as something to prevent sympathy with the protesters.
And then there's that bit later when all the other characters are meeting and they're having a chat, and they go, "Did you see the news?" And they go, "Yeah, we heard about the attack on Prince Regent," and they laugh and they joke it was probably a potato. Them assuming that he's exaggerating whatever it is, and obviously we are the only ones who know, if I've read it correctly.
Yeah.
We're the only ones who know that they've actually hit the nail on the head and it was a potato.
Yes. It makes it clear that this was a driven plot to discredit the radicals. But actually, there is a tradition also that the massacre was engineered by the government in order for them to be able to have a crackdown. And that theory, I don't think, really comes up in the movie. So, you know, Mike's not playing fast and loose with the truth, I think, in his desire to raise people's fury. I think there was one more 50-50 I had, which is that it is resolutely without melodrama. It's lots of drama, but it's resolutely without melodrama.
Hmm.
Do you know, I would generally think that's a good thing, but in this case, maybe it could have done with a bit more melodrama. Anyway, those are my feelings of the film. Overall, I was very pleased. I had seen it, and it didn't live down to my low expectations. What about you, Wolf?
Yeah, I quite enjoyed it. It's definitely too long, and it's not exactly subtle, but I am not particularly against what it's doing. And I also thought it was weird. I don't know. I couldn't believe the coincidence that you had selected it right now. We almost watched this movie when it came out in 2018. And I feel like watching the film then would have been one thing, but watching it now after the kind of year we've had and the events that are happening while we're recording and everything, it feels so much more prescient than it did when it was being made and released only a few years ago.
Obviously, I'd like to tell you that it was because of my political nous, but in actual fact, it was to do with fish and chips.
Yes, good. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was inspiring. I thought it was eye-opening and thought-provoking. I honestly don't know how you could watch this film and not be a little bit mad at the world, if not incredibly incensed. I really liked that it opens at Waterloo. Now, I know it's a bit obvious to go from Waterloo to Peterloo, but that being said, I thought it was a really useful piece of contextual history. And for one that has such, that is so iconic to our national history, it conveys so much so quickly by putting Joseph there and then showing him walking home, especially when, juxtaposed against everything that's going on in the Houses of Parliament and all the money they want to bestow upon Wellington and all the pride they have about this event, when we know that it's an event that ignores the suffering of so many, but is hailed as this great victory.
I mean, much like much of the rest of the film, it is a bit hammering over you the head with a big hammer saying, "Have you got the point?" But nonetheless, it is neat, you know, the horror of Waterloo for the working classes, by the people who actually fought in it, juxtaposed with the vast benefits bestowed upon the few at the top, gives you a very nice inequality perspective.
Yeah, and it's definitely a perspective that I had not really considered about Waterloo previously, not in any incarnation I had watched. That's not to say that films don't present war as horror, but it was an interesting view considering the kind of joy that is experienced back in England afterwards. And I also quite liked physically watching him walk from Waterloo all the way back to Manchester. It was a nice little narrative device to kind of bring us into the setting that we're going to stay in.
Although I did note one thing, which is he didn't go through Loughborough. And I thought that was a big failure of the film. They really should have shown him going through, you know, the heart of England.
Well, let's mark it down.
Okay, let's mark it down. Sorry, carry on. You were saying something sensible.
No, that was a very valid point. Mike Lee, you suck. what some other things I noticed? We argue that it's probably too long and there's too much detail put into it. But I think there are times when that level of detail can be beneficial. For example, I thought that the sections with the women's movements that were in support of the men, at first I thought, oh, it's kind of repeating stuff, but it has a payoff in the end. And I thought that it adds more complexity to the story, especially when you see them being jeered at by other bystanders, some of which are women, for not fulfilling their roles as mothers and wives. And then when you see horror inflicted upon them during the massacre, it was just wider consideration of everyone in society at that time, not this narrow focus on just a few individuals. It really encompassed the entire community.
Yeah. What did you think of the magistrates?
I was thinking about when we did the Charge of the Light Brigade, and we often discussed this lions led by donkeys approach. And I really felt that this movie was like sharks led by wolves, led by snakes. And it was really going all in on every single one of them is the most evil they could possibly be. Now, they're caricatures, and they're so clearly caricatures. Everything turned up to 11. Evil turned up to 11. That's what it feels like. But that being said, I do appreciate that they have conflict with each other. They have different viewpoints to each other. They're all evil, but they do have different ways that they ways that they see the world. And I think that is a testament to this film that it's able to make every single character in this giant collection of performers individual. And you do kind of see the different ways that the system and the government and the law would crack down on these people and the kind of different pressures that these people are under, essentially.
I was expecting a hideous caricature. I don't think it was quite as hideous, actually, as we might think. I mean, it was pretty hideous, but actually, in fact, when you look at the characters and how they behave, you know, there's nothing, he's not picking it up that much. There's one bit, I think, where the court scene, which is very, I think, a very good idea of letting you know where power lies in society. I don't think you needed to have the magistrate laughing and mocking the person in the dock.
Spittle flying from his mouth.
Yes. So I think there's probably a bit of bigging it up going on there. But nonetheless, what the point the film makes is this is where power is at a local level in society in 1819.
When I say they're caricatured, I don't necessarily mean it as a complete negative. I just think that the movie doesn't want to muddy the waters. Generally, the movie is like, we should not be on the side of any of these characters at all. And we should know that they don't consider the working class to have any worth or value as human beings. And it doesn't hide from that viewpoint. And then the end of the movie is the Prince Regent saying, we should cheer them on for the massacre that they've carried out. They've done their country proud and they did what we told them we needed them to do. So we've watched these evil characters commit evil acts and atrocities. And then in the end, they're rewarded for those atrocities.
So one final question. I have also said that I'm not sure I felt particular personal engagement in any individuals because of the breadth of the characters. What did you feel? Did you feel engaged with those people as individuals? Did you think they were well drawn?
So I'm a bit torn on this because the ending definitely has impact upon me. And it has impact because I recognize so many of the people in the crowd. So it has achieved something in that. And I definitely care about a lot of them. But that being said, I don't really have a strong connection or affinity to any of the characters, not a single character, because there are so many and they all have such small moments. I guess that especially in contrast to the magistrates, I think that the working class and the people of the rally and the people of Manchester, they're slightly more complex as individuals. Like, you get to see, as you've already said, all their different views on what they should be doing and how they should fight back and what action should they be taking and if they should be taking it. And they're having all these discussions amongst themselves. And we get to see their interactions with neighbors and friends, with their family. I don't know. We get a real insight into their lives, and that side of their life is actually genuinely developed. There's like the scenes with the shopping and selling of the eggs, because they need to make pies. And I enjoyed seeing the detail in the everyday life, like how they live at this time. I thought that was really good. And I guess what I would say is that, yes, they aren't particularly developed, but I don't want to do them a disservice, because I do think that it kind of works within the context of the film. And it's maybe the right strategy to go broad than to focus on just a few people.
Okay, so let's move on to the history then. I'm going to read you a poem, darling. Okay, I can reassure you it's not a love poem, although I've always assumed that that was the only purpose for poetry, because, you know, poetry is by and large incomprehensible. But here is a poem which I think is quite comprehensible. You ready? Are you in hearing poetry mode?
Always.
Excellent. An old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king. Princes, the dregs of their dull race, who flow through public scorn, mud from a muddy spring. Rulers who neither see, nor feel, nor know, but leech-like to their fainting country cling, till they drop blind in blood without a blow. A people starved and stabbed in the untilled field, an army whom liberticide and prey makes a two-edged sword to all who wield golden and sanguine laws which tempt and slay. Religion Christless, godless, a book sealed, a senate, time's worst statue unrepealed, our graves from which a glorious phantom may burst to illuminate our tempestuous day. Who wrote that poem?
Is it written about either the Peterloo Massacre or just this period of time in general? I'm assuming so.
It's written in the same year, actually. I think there's another poem written after it. It was written by Mary's husband.
Which Mary?
Mary Shelley.
Oh, Percy Shelley.
Percy, that's right. That is a flavour of the radical's view. And I think he writes a poem called The Mask of Anarchy, actually, which is specifically about the Peterloo Massacre. Mm. I think the one failing of the film, but I don't know how he could put it right, or when we think about the film, we need to think about, is that this is a period of blind panic by the ruling classes. So what has happened with industrialization, which we always talk about industrialization as the impact it has on the working classes, because their lives are thrown up into the air and they find themselves in a completely different situation. But you need to think also a little bit about the oppressors. I know we don't like them thinking sympathetically about oppressors, but nonetheless, in order to understand their situation, you need to understand that many of the bonds that have held society together have broken. England has been moving for some time from a feudal society to a capitalist one, and many of the old bonds have broken, and a population has grown, poverty has grown to some degree, as well as wealth. Great inequality has grown. Well, I don't know if it's grown, but inequality is very visible. People are not set in their parish as they used to be. There are these very big towns all over the place. We've just had the Napoleonic War, and we now have a terrible recession. The French Revolution has just happened, with the terror associated with that. So the ruling classes are in ferment, not just about the Napoleonic Wars, but also about all this, the vagrancy that goes on. So we're in a period of history where the common law that we love to talk about as being a great achievement of English civilization. Actually, at this time, you've got something called the Bloody Code. There are more ways of being killed by the law than any other law in Europe. Plus, you've got all the transportation going on. So you have to kind of understand that context, that those people, those magistrates, feel under incredible panic and pressure. So Lord Liverpool is judged in various ways. So he's described by Disraeli as the arch mediocrity, which is a lovely insult. He's very Disraeli. But a historian's view, a historian called Norman Gash, his view about the English terror, as it's called, the security measures taken by Lord Liverpool at this time, are this. The security measures taken from between 1817 and 1820 were recognized as relatively moderate response by contemporary standards to a difficult situation, and Liverpool's desire to encroach as little as possible on constitutional liberties received belated acknowledgement. So what I thought you needed to understand from the movie a little bit, but I don't know how the movie could do it, is this sense of national panic and the sense of breaking social bonds. So what you're left with, until radicalism begins to change people's minds and hearts, and you go through a process in the 19th century, people have feudal attitudes. So in the 16th century, the law, and indeed earlier, the law was that if you were a vagrant in the wrong parish without permission, you could be whipped and put in the stocks. If you committed adultery, you could be whipped. You could be made to stand at the front of the church and with your candle in order to confess to your shame and to the rest of the congregation. So when we look at these events, it's quite difficult to think of it with the mindset of somebody of the time and where they've come from. So that's the only thing that it's very difficult in a film like this, impossible probably, to get your mind round the panic and pressure that people are under. But in terms of not exaggerating and how hideous those judges really were, here is a quote, an actual quote from one of the judges. In the first trial of those who attended the meeting at St. Peter's Field, the judge commented, I believe you are a downright blackguard reformer. Some of you reformers ought to be hanged. Some of you are sure to be hanged. The rope is already round your necks. So that is the kind of attitude that you have at the time. You know, Mike Lee's not bigging it up. That is how society works. And there is the breaking of these bonds during the process of industrialization meant that personal relationship and that two-way contract you had with an individual who might have very few rights anyway, as it happens, but you knew, you lived in the same parish with, you knew personally, those bonds are breaking down and there's no structure to replace it to help get through situations like this. It's quite interesting. I'm rabbiting on and I'll stop in a moment. It's quite interesting also in the film that you see the reading of the Riot Act.
Yeah.
And quite often there's a lot of legalistic discussion. And in doing this series about the British Constitution, I'm constantly reminded that what's written on paper about, you know, British liberties is all very well, but it kind of rather falls down in the operation of the law. So, you know, if you're a big, powerful duke, the law is not going to treat you in the same way as if you're, you know, radical Bamford, as it were. And in fact, there's an interesting story about Samuel Bamford that he goes in 1820, the following years, he walks to London. You know, he stops at Woburn in Hertfordshire. And because he's walked and because he's obviously not one of the hoi polloi, they won't serve him breakfast because he's just walked in. He's not, you know, a member of rich enough to own a horse. That's the kind of society we're talking about. So great, these liberties, all these laws that they keep talking about and think, how do we cope with this? And you've got to read the Riot Act and you've got to remember this bit of law. It's all very well, but the operation of it is unequal. So I thought, historically, it's very thorough. Kind of have to know, I think, properly understand what's in the minds of the magistrates. You need to understand more background than you could possibly book in a film. But the film itself, I don't think goes wildly far in caricature.
Interesting. I also think the film, well, at least the film seemed to me pretty good at conveying so much of the history that it needed me to know, so that I understood everything that they were fighting for, and thus everything that was in place currently. And it was fast. I didn't know a lot of this, so I did think it was interesting to learn this period of time and discover, I guess, how we get to be where we are now. And obviously, if you didn't know from this film, Mike Lee is a big Labour supporter, and he was one of the...
No.
He signed the confidence.
I had him down in the Brexit party.
Ah, okay.
I had him as a Farage lover.
Well, anyway, I was just going to say that he had signed that document that went around a year or two ago in support of Jeremy Corbyn. And I often see him joining up with various businesses that are having like labor disputes or union problems. He'll often be on the side of the workers versus the employers, and he'll wade in and give his support.
I mean, we're going to talk about, you know, the relevance of the film and its relevance to today. And without getting into any of, you know, the individual party politics and all the rest of it, I would say that there are a couple of things either way. From my point of view, you might disagree. From my point of view, it's very important to us to understand just how hard it is to change society in the fundamental way that society changed during the 19th century, and indeed has changed over the 20th century. That the things that we take as standard now and get a bit cross about, we've been through a process that has cost blood. And the other thing, the corollary of that, is to value what we have. And this is the conservative in me speaking. There's so much outrage all the time these days. Fine, and probably very well meant and very well deserved. But look at where we've come. And there's a generational thing as regards this, I think. So much cultural change, I'm preaching here, I'm sorry. Much cultural change happens not because of also because of what necessarily just because of what people do, although that's important. That's the most important thing. But also you have to wait generationally. Cultural change takes a long time. So the Reformation, we think of the Reformation as being, you know, Henry VIII. And there's kind of one view which just says, right, in 1533, we're a Catholic country. In 1534, we're a Protestant country. It's completely wrong. It's not really until the generations have changed that England is a Protestant country by the death of Elizabeth I at the end of the beginning of the 17th century. Change, cultural change of this can take generations. Anyway, I've gone on long enough. I think it does have great resonance with now, but in more ways than one. For me, it's not just about an outrage thing. My God, aren't the ruling classes hideous? It's also about the cost of liberty, what it takes, and how important it is to hold on to it.
Yeah, I thought it was very inspiring. I don't know, I was deeply fascinated. And I kept thinking about how, obviously, we're always talking about proportional representation. So I can see you on Twitter on the same day arguing for more proportional representation, and then watching this movie and seeing these people arguing to have any type of a voice at all, you know, 200 years ago. And the women in this film, there's no consideration, even amongst them, that they will have a chance to vote, because that's absurd to even consider, since the men don't have a vote. And then the people you vote for don't even represent your area and have no connection with you. So you have literally no say in the government. Just to see even how far we've come since then to now is staggering. But I guess what's always interesting is how, I guess, we'll always be in this state of fighting for something more. So it feels really relevant, even though what they're asking for is something we currently have. The urgency and the kind of pressure they're under is something that does connect to us at this moment.
I think so too.
Well, okay, so I had a couple of questions. First of all, had you ever heard of the Peterloo Massacre before this movie?
Yes, I did it at school. I'm constantly going on to Twitter things, actually, and saying, oh, I did this at school, where people are getting outraged about we don't do enough Irish history, or we don't do enough black history, or we don't know about slavery and all the rest of it. I'm saying, oh, interesting. So I'm beginning to think either people have got a point, an axe to grind, and they you know, they're just making a point which isn't made in truth. Or I had this fantastic history education at a grammar school, which, you know, it was all gone wrong.
Okay. And then I guess, well, I had never heard of it. So it wasn't so much.
Something's gone wrong with our education then.
Well, no, I think it's just always changing. We're just studying different things. But I did notice from kind of a little bit of loose reading that this event wasn't really memorialized. I think it was one blue plaque, and it was a blue plaque that had questionable phrasing that didn't really suggest that the people of Manchester were brutally slain, but that there was some conflict of which it was like a two sides, everyone's kind of bad thing. And I definitely got the impression that it wasn't really memorialized until very recently, I guess in conjunction with the film. So there is a point to make that, yes, you studied it at school, but it is an event that most people aren't aware of. And I do wonder if part of that is because it takes place up north. I do think we have a bit of a problem, or maybe, not necessarily a problem, but at least in the south, maybe I have less understanding of the issues that have taken place now or in the past in other parts of the country.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I hadn't considered that.
Do you think you studied it because you lived further north when you were at school?
Well, you know, Loughborough is the crowning achievement of English civilization, as you know. So maybe, I don't know, but it is a very interesting point. I don't know what to comment. I mean, I agree that we're far too, you know, great regional differences, and that's a real problem for England. Whether it strikes into history, I don't know.
I don't know. I just think it's interesting that Jane commented that once you've been to Manchester, she didn't know where this took place, didn't know where the square was. I've been to Manchester, never even heard of it. Presumably, I guess maybe, I don't know, it could be in a different part of the city because it's so developed. But you could argue that something like this needs to be remembered a bit more, especially as I read it's one of the most influential radical moments in British history that there's ever been.
I mean, that's one of the things about the film which I don't think, or the verbiage after it that necessarily does. Because it doesn't really go anywhere. Or it takes a long time for it to do. And maybe if there's a story about that, it is about the evolutionary change of English and British politics. Funnily enough, the following year, in Glasgow, there's what they call the Radical War. I mean, that's talking it up a bit, but it's a very similar type, in fact, wider protest than the Peterloo. But after that, things go back to normal, and you get people like Robert Peel who start unwinding the bloody code, and the franchise is extended in 1832 and 1867. So Britain deals with these problems in a very British way of bit by bit improving things, giving just enough in order for people to be able to live with it rather than explode. It does feed into the Chartism movement of the mid-19th century. So a lot of the demands of Peterloo, of the Peterloo radicals, are the same as the Chartist appeals. But it isn't so well known, I think, because it's not like the French Revolution, you know, it doesn't change things.
Because they just get killed and crushed and suppressed.
Yes, but crudely, but also society does respond. You know, but in relatively small, granular ways. You know, the Great Reform Act follows 15 years later or whatever. So slowly government do respond. This protest is a pebble that's cast in the water, which does impact other things. But it's just that it's not as dramatic as something like the French Revolution. I mean, there's one in, I think, in London's of St. George's Field about 40, 50 years before. A very similar nature, that John Wilkes oriented thing. I bet you, have you ever heard of the Massacre of St. George's Field?
No.
There you go.
Georgia Lou.
So I absolutely agree with you. There ought to be much stronger teaching of these. Well, it's social and economic history as well as good old traditional.
Well, is this particularly brutal compared to some of these other instances you mentioned in Britain?
It's quite similar to St. George's.
Okay.
Right. The thing is, unfortunately, it's not a vast amount of it in British history and the kind of massacres we have within Britain, rather than the ones that we export, are, you know, relatively mild by European standards. for example, in France in the 16th century, 10,000 Waldensians are brutally murdered. Mm. You know, in our religious pogrom was Mary, who burnt 284 people. In the Netherlands, 1,200 people were executed for being Protestants in 1 year. So there's kind of always been this myth, which isn't entirely myth, I hate to say it, that British politics more evolutionary and less than other countries. And it has some sort of truth.
One question for you. It's maybe a two-parter. Did this film radicalize you in any way? And how effective did you find the actual massacre at the end?
I don't know whether it radicalized me, but it confirmed me in my view that we need much more social and economic history, and we need to really value these moments in our history. Sorry, what was the second question?
How effective do you think that the presentation of the massacre was in the film?
I thought it was quite good, but I don't think I felt as outraged as you did. I thought it was, to be honest, I thought it was quite functional, that it was still trying to show me what happened in some detail rather than trying to pull on my heartstrings. But maybe I'm just a deeply insensitive person, and I think that might be the case.
I think this is where the effectiveness of what's come before does kind of reveal itself. It is quite functional, but the fact that I still have the same response that I do lets me know that I must have cared about the characters that had set up.
Yeah.
Definitely, I think it was Joseph, as you were saying, that is a shocking moment because we followed Joseph throughout his journey.
Yes, I think that's been well set up as the big moment that this person who's given his life for his country and has been destroyed by that is now just savagely, you know, sabred in St. Peter's Field.
Yeah, and most of your main characters, they'll give us that nice little chat in the crowd where Maxine Peake shares some bread with those people who've travelled from Wigan. They're so determined and excited to come to this rally because they're so desperate for change that they will walk all the way from Wigan to Manchester, and then the result is, you know, brutally slain.
Absolutely, and their expectation that change can and will happen. And which is a thread, as I say, throughout English radical history, of ordinary people believing that if they can just say this stuff, people will, of course, you know, their lords and masters, their social superiors, will, of course, see the goodness in it and will do the right thing, and only to be disappointed. Anyway, we need to finish. Okay, well, first of all, quality of the film, what would you give it out of 10?
I went for a 6, but... Yeah, no, I'll stick with 6.
Okay, I've been more generous. I think I'd say 7 because, you know, I was engaged. I didn't get bored, despite the worthiness. I appreciate worthy but dull is, you know.
And I do have to admit, I knew it was long, but I guess I wasn't really bored. And I did get through the film mostly intact.
Okay, and then historical accuracy, what should we give it for that?
So I was going to guess it's an 8.
And I went for 9.
Okay.
But, you know, 8, 9, what, you know, whatever.
No, go with it.
Essentially, go with the 9. My summary of the whole thing was that this was a film I wish I'd had if I was a teacher, a history teacher. This would be a fantastic thing to show people, to give them a flavour of what radicalism was like in the 19th century.
Brilliant.
Okay, thank you very much for listening. Everybody, do come across to the Facebook site and voice your opinion and vote and all the rest of it and just have a good time.
This film is on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, should be able to get it fairly easily. Okay, thank you for coming, everybody. Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
All right, bye all.
Are you not entertained?
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.